As president of the Burkina Faso, one of Africa's poorest countries, Thomas Sankara is often referred to as the African Che Guevara. In 1987, he was assassinated during a military coup that took down his four-year-old progressive government. Despite that, Sankara's economic and social policies left an important mark not only on his country, but across the entire nation of Africa. Sankara was a Marxist and openly sought independence from France at the same time that he was building a Pan-African unity. He remains an inspiration to young people throughout that nation for his integrity, idealism, and dedication to independence and self-determination. In his recently published book, Thomas Sankara, an African Revolutionary, Ernest Harsh tells the story of Sankara's life and struggles. This is the first English-language book to report on this late leader, his leadership, and the inspiration he's created among young people throughout Africa. Professor Harsh is a research scholar at the Institute of African Studies at Columbia University. He worked on African issues at the United Nations for more than 20 years and is the author of South Africa, White Rule, Black Revolt. Ernest, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Now, tell us who Thomas Sankara was and why should our listeners care about him?
Well, he was the president of the West African country of Burkina Faso from 1983 to 1987, a very short period of time. He was a revolutionary. Everybody acknowledged that at the time, especially the French, who greatly disliked him. The U.S. wasn't too happy with him. He wanted to stop in Atlanta to meet with Andrew Young during his visit to the U.N. General Assembly. They didn't allow him to make that stop, so he spoke in Harlem instead. And it's a small West African country. Not even that many experts on Africa know much about it.
When he took over, what was it called?
It was called Upper Volta.
And he changed the name?
In the year after they took power, they changed the name. And I'll get into a little bit of that. So he was in power for only about 4 years. He was overthrown in the military coup by the second most important person in the regime, who was also head of the military, Blaise Compaoré, who was then in power for 27 years until he was overthrown last October.
Why should people care about him?
Okay, it's not a well-known country. He wasn't well-known at all. But I think for people who are interested in progressive change, it's always useful, and you know, the people are interested in seeing how others elsewhere in the world are fighting against oppression, are fighting for their rights, and occasionally are actually able to make some change. And it's also useful to learn about what kind of leadership can help people do that. And that's where his contribution was, at the leadership level. He wasn't a grassroots activist. He came out of the military. He was a captain. But he got radicalized in the military, and because of the context of his country, which was extremely poor and underdeveloped and backward and subservient to the French, who had been their former colonial power, and very corrupt, both military and civilian politicians over the decades. And people thought like him. There were many others who wanted to break out of that old system. So they were actually able to lead a revolutionary struggle and come into power, partly because they had some sectors of the military with them, but they also had a broad base of civilian support, including revolutionary civilian organizations. So they were able to do that.
You know, one of the things in your book that I read, and we're speaking with Ernest Harsh, wrote an important book, Thomas Sankara, an African Revolutionary, that I noticed was about colonialism and neocolonialism. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the African leadership that took over after the end of colonialism became neocolonialist. And he had strong words about this, as you said in your book.
This is interesting, and sort of he's widely recognized outside of Burkina in Africa as one of the heroes of a Pan-Africanist hero. But most of the others, like Patrice Lumumba, Amilcar Cabral, you know, they got their chops in fighting against colonialism. He's representing a newer generation where that initial idealism about independence will bring all sorts of changes, you know, has it begun to wear off and people were disillusioned. He's speaking to the ills of formerly independent countries that are still subservient to their colonial masters, still haven't found any way to break out of the, you know, trap of underdevelopment and external economic domination. So he's speaking to a different generation, which still resonates today. That is young people who are, you know, fed up with the way things are. They're fed up with the corruption of their leaders, whether they're elected or not elected. They're fed up with elites that are more inclined to the former colonial powers and other Western powers than they are to their own citizens. So whatever one's ideology, a lot of young people are attracted to him. I mean, you go through, travel through West Africa, you see Sankara t-shirts. You turn on the radio, there's reggae and rap artists who are quoting Sankara in their songs, and the videos are out there. So, you know, it's very popular because it resonates with the issues to today.
Yeah, some people call him the Che Guevara of Africa.
That's, I mean, I did a slideshow a couple of days ago. I had slide after slide of people with, separately, t-shirts of Che and Sankara. Some t-shirts, they had both of them on there at demonstrations with portraits of Che and of Sankara. You know, it's that image of somebody who gave their lives, struggling, you know, for freedom, for liberation, whatever the odds. And the odds in Burkina were very hard. They were very hard.
Well, I'm holding in my hand, and you can almost hold this book in your palm. It's not a pamphlet, but it's a short book, which makes it accessible, I think, and has a beautiful cover with a drawing of Thomas Sankara. And then it has a title, of course, Thomas Sankara, an African Revolutionary by Ernest Harsh. And it's part of the Ohio Short Histories of Africa series. This book was published by the Ohio University Press, of all presses. This is a very much needed book. We, of course, knew about Thomas Sankara, and there's nothing like this in English. This is fills a real need. So congratulations, Ernest, for coming out with your book. Tell us what it was like when you met him.
Well, I mean, the first time I met him was in New York at the Burkina Bay mission to the UN. He had come in to address the General Assembly and to speak up at Harlem. There was a small group of us journalists who met with him. And, you know, I mean, I've talked to and interviewed heads of state before. Not so often military officers, but, you know, I mean, the guy, he was direct. I mean, he listened to what you had to say, and he thought about it. And I've never met anybody who was so quick. I mean, he was witty. I mean, you lose it. He loved making puns, usually in French, and so they don't translate well. But he would coin words and turn things around. You know, there'd be hostile questions, and he just knew how to turn it around. And he was direct. He was, you know, he just related to you. So the other times I met him in Burkina, you know, sometimes, you know, first time was a long interview. The other times he didn't want to be interviewed. He just wanted to talk about politics. You know, how was it that the Solidarity Movement in the U.S. sent so many young Americans to Nicaragua, you know, with the pro-Sandinista brigades? Was there some way that we could tap into the African-American community and get some of them to go to Burkina or other African countries to build the solidarity across the diaspora? Or to talk about the struggle in Chad, because they were involved in some mediation stuff. Or we just talk about politics more generally. You know, he just wanted to talk. He loved it. You know, he'd listen.
What were his views on women?
Okay, this was the mid-1980s. You know, there were some advanced things in the developed countries, in the U.S. and Europe. But in Africa at the time, hardly anybody spoke about the issue of women. The usual response was, this is a Western feminist agenda. You know, this isn't African because of African traditions. Well, he broke through all that. I mean, he was an early precursor. Up to that time, nobody had promoted or named so many women to cabinet positions. At the high point, there were five women in his cabinet of about 25, 26, about, a fifth of them at least. One of them now is the current Minister of Justice, Josephine Wade Drogo. So, you know, that experience helped train some. At the local level, you know, that's elite women. They tried to organize women into the committees for the defense of the revolution, and they had quota systems. So at least two women had to be in the leadership of the seven-member CDR bureaus. They changed the family code, and this is quite a archaic, backward system in Burkina.
One second, just for our listeners, CDRs are Committees of Defense of the Revolution.
Committees for the Defense of the Revolution.
Which, of course, reminds you very much of Cuba, which had CDRs from the 60s.
Still do.
Yeah. And Cuba was a little bit of a model to them, you know. But also they tried to tackle some of the restrictions on women at the local level. It's It's hard. They made a small dent in it, like fought against female genital mutilation. Just even the right to divorce by mutual consent, you know, not just the husband's decision or the patriarch's decision. And to provide economic opportunities for women. They helped form cooperatives of women, who did fabrics, and developed this whole line of clothing called Faso Danfani, which was traditional African dress. So it was promoting African pride, but it was done by homespun cotton, because Burkina grew a lot of cotton. And it was women's cooperatives who did these, and by requiring civil servants to wear them at special occasions, there was a built-in market. Everybody had to go out and buy one of these Faso Danfani outfits. They're now a source of pride. I mean, the new prime minister, he shed his military uniform, and he's now out there in public wearing Faso Danfani. Which gets, it's a good segue to talk about the nation building aspects. I mean, you mentioned earlier, it was called Upper Volta, which was a colonial name. They wanted something African. And Burkina Faso, the words, are from two local African languages. It basically means the land of the upright, or the uncorruptible people. It can be translated different ways. And then the people are known as Burkinabé, and the Bé comes from a third African language in the country. So it's kind of a pan-territorial thing, and it's clearly African. And whatever anybody thought of Sankara, and even including right-wing conservatives in the country, nobody calls themselves Voltaics. You know, nobody wants to go back to that. They're Burkina Bé. They like it, you know, and people who travel abroad, you know, they put down their Burkina Bé passport, and it's a source of pride. And others react, oh, you're from Burkina Faso. I mean, whatever else you think about the politics, and it sort of helped knit the country together in a way that hadn't been before. So, I mean, that's, if you're a revolutionary, you don't have a coherent nation, that's not a bad starting point.
Ernest Harsh, talk to us about Thomas Sankara's foreign policy.
Well, clearly, he demonstrated that before he became president, because he was briefly a prime minister in a coalition government. His first trip was to Libya. So he got a big welcome there and invited Gaddafi back. So people originally said, oh, he was a pawn of Gaddafi. He made that clear early on because Gaddafi said, look, we have this green book, you know, maybe you should check it out. And he said, look, I quoted in the book, you know, we're not political virgins. Thank you. But we have our own experience. And then he went to the non-aligned summit in New Delhi and gave this very fiery speech, basically solidarizing with the Cuban Revolution, with the Nicaraguans, with the Western Saharans, with the New Caledonians then, or the Kanak struggle against France. It was very, very hot, and he clearly aligned himself with the anti-imperialist, pro-third world, pro-development wing within the non-aligned movement. The French didn't like that, so they told some of their people locally, okay, let's get rid of this guy. They had an internal coup. He was arrested in prison for a while, and then but they couldn't sustain that. It was too popular. There was a reaction against it demanding his freedom, and the civilian supporters organized, and eventually then they came to power and, you know, freed him, and he became president.
Kind of a parallel with what happened with Hugo Chavez.
A little bit like that, yeah, but a much shorter period of time. He didn't have a long period in prison. They just, because the people carried out the pro-French coup just didn't have the support to sustain it.
This was in 1983.
83, yeah. That very quick series of events in 1983 led to the revolution. Then when he was president, he just demonstrated the same thing. I mean, he was the first African head of state to visit the liberated areas in Western Sahara with Polisario. He played a key role within the Organization of African Union then in getting the Saharan Republic recognized as a member of the OAU. So that prompted Morocco's withdrawal from the organization. It's still the case. He went to Cuba a number of times. When he came to the U.S., you know, he would usually pass through Cuba, come to the U.S., go back through Cuba. Once he went to Cuba, then did a trip to Nicaragua, side trip for it was an anniversary of the Sandinista Liberation Front. And he spoke on behalf of all the foreign delegations to a crowd of several hundred thousand in Managua.
You remember the year? It would have been July, because that was the anniversary of the revolution, not the Sandinista.
Then I'm thinking 85 or 86. Yeah, I can't remember exactly.
The likelihood
were you there, Michael?
Oh, very, good possibility. I went to every one of them, so I was probably there, but do I remember anything?
Well, this wasn't the anniversary of the Revolution, but of the founding of the Sandinista Liberation.
So I wasn't there. Anyway.
Needless to say, you could expect France, the U.S., to earmark this guy as somebody who probably should be eliminated. Fortunately for them, they found forces within the country, within the leadership itself, who were uncomfortable with the direction things were taking. Some of them probably were corrupt inclined, and they didn't like the anti-corruption campaigns. And Campoori, who was the head of the military, he was the Minister of Defense, married a daughter of Houphouët Boigny, the president of Côte d'Ivoire next door. It was very pro-French. So there was that direct line. And, you know, there were differences over how open or narrow to organize the political process in Burkina Faso. Sankara was more open-minded. He wanted a broader, inclusive kind of political organization. The other ones were small, little, very narrow, student-based, university-based, leftist groups who admired Enver Hoxha of Albania, Joseph Stalin, and they were more comfortable with sort of top-down, repressive kinds of approach. So there were differences, and, you know, the Campoori played into that and carried out the coup.
I want to talk a little bit more about the coup, but before we do, we talked about foreign policy. Tell us about domestically in those 4 years. What kinds of things he was doing, what he was shifting, why some people opposed it.
Okay. Well, in Africa, he's most known for the foreign policy stuff. In Burkina, he's most known for the domestic stuff. I mean, they like that foreign policy stance too, but especially on the domestic front. I already mentioned the nation building. We talked about what he did on women. He tried to refashion the entire state apparatus. I mean, they put hundreds of officials on trial for corruption. And these were public trials. The public could attend, so they educated people about how the old regimes and old officials would misuse their power. He then extended in the last year or so of his life to current office holders, you know, trying to keep that from happening to the current leadership. They totally restructured the state. They ensured that, well, look, this is a very rural country. Only a tiny fraction of the population lived in the cities. And insofar as any public investments went to development, they went to those few cities. He reversed that. He and his comrades, I should say, reversed that. They whatever they had, and they didn't have a lot, very poor country, they emphasized investments in the rural areas, health clinics, schools. Every village, there were about 7,000, they established a primary health care center. I don't know how many schools they built, or they didn't build necessarily the government, but they encouraged people, local people, to gather the materials and build, and then the authorities would provide expert opinion. Water was a key thing. I mean, so they built irrigation canals, water reservoirs. Very poor country, so revolutionary steps in such a poor country can often be very basic. And it demonstrated to people on the ground that this was a government different from those before. There's a lot of cynicism about politicians. And, you know, in rural areas, I talked to people. And, well, you know, they weren't quite sure about these guys from Ouagadougou, but, you know, they seemed to be doing something more than had ever been done before. On economic development, it was emphasizing domestic resources and mobilization and markets. They were trying gradually to break free of a dependence on just exporting cotton to earn money. They took steps against the local merchant class who would engage in speculation. There wasn't really any industrial manufacturing sector to talk about, so, I mean, they didn't go through wholesale nationalizations, except a lot of the state enterprises had been run privately pretty much and corruptly, so they cleaned those up. Also, he was also a precursor not just on the issue of women, but of sustainable development. Planting trees, making sure that the environment was taken into account. And this was a couple of years before the UN's Earth Summit in Rio. And in Africa at the time, again, environmental issues were seen somehow as a Western plot to deny Africa industrialization. But he saw that, no, I mean, these are poor countries, depend on the environment. I mean, agriculture depends on rainfall, so you use whatever water you can, you harvest it. So there was the sustainability aspect. And inequality throughout. Not that there were grave differences in people's living standards. Almost everybody was fairly poor except for the small elites. Everything was sort of equity. You know, the top government officials, they get rid of their luxury cars. They, you know, their salaries would get slashed. They get rid of their housing bonuses. And then what they had got invested into sectors of the economy and social services that were important for poor people.
Ernest, on the day that Sankara was killed, October 15, 1987, assassinated, you were actually in Burkina Faso, right?
I was. I wasn't in the capital. I was in the small village of Pibo Ore.
Tell us about that.
Well, the village, I mean, we were there. There was a farmers' rally, and we reviewed some of the water reservoir clinics and other things that had been built by villagers. And there was a little bit of a rally, you know, and some people with Sankara T-shirts there. We didn't know what was going on at the Capitol at the time. The rally finished, and at a certain point on the radio, suddenly started to hear military music. I mean, this is typical for coups. You start hearing military music, uh-oh. And people started getting concerned. No news came out, except later in the evening there was an announcement that Sankara's autocratic regime had been overthrown and a new popular front was in power, headed by Blaise Compaoré. We didn't even know Sankara had been killed yet. Got back to Ouagadougou the next day and found out.
Can you explain how he was assassinated?
He was in a meeting with about 12 of his aides and bodyguards. And it was, I think it was around somewhere between 4 and 5 on the afternoon of the 15th. And a units we later learned were under the command of officers loyal to Compaoré. Compaoré always denied he gave orders, but things didn't happen within the military without orders from higher up. They burst in and basically just immediately started shooting. He, you know, once it started, a couple of his guards were killed outside. He thought, okay, they're here for me. So he went outside to meet them, thinking that maybe his other aides and comrades would be spared. They shot him. There wasn't even much of an exchange. He was killed. They went into the room and mowed down everybody else. There was only one survivor. He later gave an account of that.
How old was he at the time?
He was 37. He was only 33 when he became president. So, you know, this was a youthful leadership.
And who became president after him?
Blaise Compaoré.
And he remained president until?
Until October of last year.
Now, in that period, which is what, almost how many
27 years?
27 years. Even that government, Compaoré, had to begin to recognize something positive about Sankara, at least something, because they originally had him in sort of an unmarked grave or some grave outside, you said in the book, with his dozen people who were killed. And then slowly they had to do something more for Sankara, even within that government. Is that right?
Well, that actually began from the very beginning, because they tried to organize support marches for the new government. They failed, because people would come out and start stoning them, especially students. I went to the cemetery where the grave was, and hundreds of people went. They were mourning. They weren't cheering the new government, obviously, and they were opposing any effort by the new government to do support demonstrations. They'd leave flowers at the gravesite, messages, you know, Mama Sankara, we will avenge you, you know, we are all Sankara, things like that. So it was a very unpopular government initially, and they had to retract or at least step back from their very severe invective against Sankara. And they actually claimed to be continuing the revolution. They called it a rectification. After a few years, they just dropped even the revolutionary rhetoric. They went, because of pressure from France, they organized multi-party elections, which Compaoré's people organized a dominant party, which controlled every election since then. Continued repression. It wasn't until about 2000 or so, well, actually by the 1990s, political groups who called themselves Sankarist, that is, followers of Sankara, could begin to organize, run elections, and they got people elected. So there was a residual base of support for Sankara. Of course, anybody who was critical of the Compaoré regime, that would be a natural pull to drift toward. The opposition had other currents as well, more conservative, but the Sankarists have consistently been a major electoral draw. even though the elections were not free and fair. Despite the limitations, they were always able to get people elected, and you know, they were in the limelight. So come October last year, I mean, this was actually a year-long process. Campoore, who had already been in power for so long, there was a constitution that said, you know, there were limits to how many times you could be president, get reelected. He started, and his people started, to try to amend the constitution to allow him at least one more term, maybe two more, maybe three more. And this was just too much. I mean, people were tired of this regime. Even the moderate opposition, they started organizing demonstrations. It got bigger and bigger and bigger. Finally, in October, they said, okay, well, we're not even going to hold a referendum on this. We're just going to have the National Assembly vote to change the Constitution. They had the number of seats in the National Assembly to do that. So the demonstrators, you know, they ratcheted it up. One demonstration in Ouagadougou was like a million people. This is not a big country. I mean, the population of the capital is 1.5 million. This was huge, and that was around the entire country. The youth activists said, okay, well, you know, demonstrations aren't going to be enough. We have to confront the security forces, not with arms, but just defy the attempts to keep them from demonstrating. Everybody now calls it a popular insurrection over 2 days, October 30th and 31st. It was an insurrection in the sense that they defied the military and the riot police. Gradually, sectors of security forces, especially the regular army, and some of the police started showing sympathy for the demonstrators. You know, the demonstrators would march, they hit a roadblock, and maybe they negotiated passage, or then they just found another way to get to their goal. The morning that the National Assembly was going to vote to change the Constitution, they couldn't, because demonstrators took it over, they smashed it up, burned it down, and chased all the deputies away. They took over and smashed up the national television and radio. They went to the National Army headquarters and rallied outside in large numbers and said, okay, you got to remove this guy. Some of the soldiers shot into the demonstrators. About 24 were killed. But most of them decided it would, given how many people were in the streets, this would have been a horrible bloodbath, and they weren't going to have that amount of blood on their hands. So they basically forced Campoore to resign. The French sent in special forces. They got him out of the country, because who knows what would have happened if they hadn't. Or maybe they were worried that, you know, if he were captured and brought to trial, some of the secrets that they didn't want to come out would come out. So an interim government was established with some military participation, a lot of civilian activists from civil society. These are human rights activists. These are, you know, like the kind of friends you have, who there's an interim parliament that got established. A newspaper editor who was known as a Sankarist, Sharif C, was elected president of that. And a coalition government was established that had some mostly technocrats, but I mentioned Josephine Ouédraogo and others who were known supporters of Sankara in it. They're only going to be in power for a year. They're supposed to organize elections in October, and then we'll see when the elections happen how the different political currents fare out. But it's like a vindication of the Sankara era. I mean, he's a hero. The president and the prime minister would not only talk about Sankara as a hero, but actually talk about what the revolution accomplished in terms of popular mobilization and, you know, getting the spirit of the country geared in. I mean, it's amazing to see this Lieutenant Colonel Zita, who's the prime minister, he's a lieutenant colonel, came out of the old presidential guard, standing up at a mass demonstration. People want him to speak, so he's dressed in Faso Danfani and he's pumping his fist and he's saying everything that he knows the crowds want to hear. Whether he believes it or not, that's another question, but, you know, that's the context and that's the pressure that the new authorities are under.
I think it matters whether he believes it or not. As Lenin said, no one's ever invented a sincero meter. If he says it and people hold him to it, that's enough. But, you know, on reflection, in the 2 decades before Sankara was executed, we lost Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Che, who were all about the same age. And then to have this happen again 20 years later, the only exception I can think of is that the bodyguards around Castro were effective enough to ward off some 620 assassination attempts. But here, unfortunately, it didn't happen. Anyway, you've brought us up to date and told us a happy ending to this story, Ernest, and we're grateful.
We've been speaking with Ernest Harsh, author of a really wonderful short book, Thomas Sankara, an African Revolutionary. Recommend it to everybody. It's a history most of you probably are not familiar with. Thank you, Ernest.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.